Oh, I think it needs to be zoomed in like by no amount at all, and then I'd be happy. Anyway, okay.
Never living it down.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the TLDR podcast. I am
Rory.
Who are you?
I don't think I was. Okay.
That's damn Rory.
An impassioned
Zach was speaking over me, if anything. Yeah. All right. Silence.
Let's just
ready.
Calmer. Anyway, okay, ready? Hello and welcome to another episode of the TLDR podcast. I'm Zach Michaelis and I'm joined today by Rory Taylor and Ben Blissett.
Hello.
There we go. Just a quick heads up before we get into things. We are only going to be doing one podcast a week from now on in. Previously, we were obviously doing two a week. One was on global topics and one was on UK topics. We're now just doing one a week and it will sort of oscillate depending on the news cycle. On you know global and UK topics. This week, however, our main story is going to be UK, and it's going to be about David Cameron specifically and whether or not he's upstaging Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, which has been a sort of recurring theme in British politics for the last couple of months or so. But before we get into that, we are going to do our unreported stories. So can I start with Rory?
So my underreported story is sort of goes back a full year. So two days ago, as of recording, was the anniversary of the beginning of the civil war in Sudan. And I think as a conflict that's gone, well, at least after a few weeks of when it was widely covered, I think it's fallen out of the headlines a lot. You know, we've got Ukraine, we've got Gaza, loads of different conflicts that are sort of battling for attention, I suppose. But Sudan's a massive conflict, massive humanitarian crisis, no end in sight. Even after their year, you've got the RSF versus the Sudanese Armed Forces. So the RSF is a paramilitary group and the Armed Forces is just the country's army. The RSF was sort of on the front foot for much of the first part of the war, whereas now the army is sort of gaining momentum, which I think is quite a dangerous situation because I think both sides think they can win.
Yeah.
And that's probably the worst possible situation to have, where both sides think they can win, and if they think it's like a battle to the death, then they're just going to keep fighting. And there's not much chance for a ceasefire. So I just think it hasn't got as much attention as it should have done, because it's a pretty consequential war. It's also a really interesting one, because it's not just contained to Sudan. You've got potential spillovers to like South Sudan and Chad, and also this wild sort of sub story where you've got Russian Wagner mercenaries there, but also Ukrainian special forces on the ground in Sudan, which is sort of a crazy subplot, I think.
And then that is wild. It reminds me quite a lot of the situation in 2022 when there was the Ethiopian civil war going on at the same time as Ukraine, in the same way that in some sense Sudan has been like drowned out by Israel. Obviously the Ethiopian war was drowned out by Ukraine, despite the fact that the number of casualties obviously in Ethiopia was far higher than that of Ukraine. Not saying it's necessarily more important, but there was a sort of discrepancy in how much one war was covered than the other.
I mean, also Ukraine has sort of been drowned out in a way as well now, but then I guess it's all a cycle and things come around, but
you're quite depressing, actually.
Yeah, sorry to start
lots
on that
of wars
note.
And we don't even know about most of them. Anyway, Ben, what is your underreported story?
So mine is sort of continuing on that theme. It was revealed today, I think, by the BBC. They've done some independent analysis into the number of deaths on the Russian side in the war in Ukraine. So obviously, figures released from Russia are usually sort of thin and far between, and they're not always the most reliable. So the BBC has sort of predicted that it's around 50,000, the death toll, across the more than 2 years that the conflict's been going on, and that the amount of death in the last 12 months, sorry, the second year of the war compared to the first, is about 25% higher than the first year, which is obviously quite significant.
That is interesting. It's higher this year than it was last year.
Yeah, so they're saying that obviously, Russia has been using this sort of like meat grinder strategy. They've been using that in a number of different, most notably like the Battle for Bakhmut. I think one of the things that happens in the news a lot is that you get this sort of geopolitical influence and the impact of all of this.
Did you mean Avdiivka, by the way? Just because Bakhmut was mostly last year. Avdiivka's this.
Sorry. Yes. The death in the first year was largely to do with the meat grinder strategy. But yeah, they've been using it in a number of different cities and continued that into the second year, hence the high death count. But as I say, I think the media a lot of the time focuses on the geopolitical significance and like the moving boundaries within Russia and Ukraine and doesn't often focus on death count, probably because there isn't too much to actually report on, because the countries generally keep them to themselves. It's worth noting as well that Ukraine doesn't really release many, you know, much information about their death count either. And the figures that they've released as well, the US has suggested it's higher than what they've published as well. But yeah, I think it's worth commenting on the just insane sort of death toll in that conflict, especially because, as Rory's just pointed out, Ukraine's been falling out of the news cycle slightly because of the Israel-Gaza conflict. So yeah, worth reflecting on, I think.
It ties in quite nicely, actually, with a story that was one of the underreported stories last week, which was Georgina's, about the Russian military's over-reliance on ethnic minorities when it comes to the war in Ukraine. I think it's, you know, there's an interesting sort of almost academic question about how to sort of recalibrate to find the correct death toll off official records. But I do think it's interesting that whatever the actual number is, the Kremlin does seem to be mostly politically insulated from those, the body bags that are coming back. And I think that probably is in part because of its reliance of ethnic minorities in slightly more less politically important regions.
Well, prisoners as well is another big one.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, good point. Okay, so my unreported story is sort of underreported. We've done a video on it. Rory's actually done a video on it that came out today. Is just about Biden overtaking Trump in the polls. I think this is a massive story just because obviously the presidential election is at least the most significant election this year, probably in, I mean, I was going to say in our lifetimes. I mean, that sounds a bit grandiose, but it's a very, very important presidential election. And it's been sort of barely remarked upon that the polls have sort of flipped. And it does feel like the media narrative is still sort of in, it still feels like Trump has the momentum, even though the polling suggests the reverse is true. And I think there's probably reason to think that actually that trend will continue for the next couple of months. But we're going to talk about that probably a bit later on the episode, so we'll leave it for then. Okay, so the main story, though, is going to be about David Cameron, who was actually quite heavily featured on last week's podcast. And today we're just going to take a little bit of a deep dive and see, well, whether or not we think he is actually upstaging Rishi Sunak and, you know, potentially why that is. So, Ben, do you want to start us off?
Yeah.
Do you think he is upstaging Rishi Sunak?
So I think in some key senses, I think he is. So when he was first taken on as foreign secretary, you saw him go to, you know, he visited Israel. He met with a lot of the senior leaders. He's met with the head of the Palestinian Authority. He's sort of been all around the world. And I think the thing that has really set him aside from Rishi Sunak is he's not only been doing this, but he's been very good at sort of publicizing this and putting together these short videos explaining to the public what he's been doing. And I think this is something that we've seen Rishi Sunak really struggle with since he's been prime minister. I know that me and you actually had a bit of an argument when Rishi Sunak first became prime minister about whether he'd be good at media.
Yeah.
And my argument at the time was, look at him in lockdown, you know, him with his eat out to help out and everything else, the furlough scheme. He was very good at selling that. He was very popular sort of chancellor at the time. That would continue into him being prime minister. I'm happy to admit now that I was completely wrong on that. He's been pretty awful at media since he's become prime minister.
In your defense, I think some of it is that he was quite good at talking about the economy.
Yeah.
Especially when the sort of economic headwinds were relatively positive, or when he was spending lots of money. And he still is quite good at talking about the economy. But he's clearly not very comfortable talking about foreign policy.
And he's been particularly bad at that. But he's not only foreign policy. You know, when he's announcing sort of domestic legislation that he's introducing, he's resorted to what can only be really described as gimmicks. Like this whole thing about, you know, banning phones in schools, something that was sort of already, he didn't really do much on that.
Yeah.
And he did this whole thing of pretending to be interrupted by his phone. And obviously Labour has used that a lot since. And just other sort of similar gimmicks in these sort of like Twitter videos. Whereas David Cameron, since becoming foreign secretary, he does these sort of routine updates where he's just walking, talking very freely to a camera and uploaded them. And they've sort of been roundly, you know, it's roundly sort of like impressed journalists. It's impressed, you know, people who've been watching. They've been very clean, very sort of like to the point, doesn't resort to gimmicks, very much makes him look like a statesman. And I think that the reason that people think that David Cameron is upstaging Rishi Sunak is sort of partly to do with the substance of what he's been doing, how like the interactions he's been having with foreign leaders, and the fact that Rishi Sunak is largely uninterested in foreign affairs, and he's just been able to sort of capitalize on that. And at the minute in the media, you know, the Israel and Gaza is very much the like main talking point.
Yeah.
So it's just by virtue of that, he's upsetting because that's his sort of remit. But also, he's just better at communicating what he's been doing.
It's both substance and style,
yeah,
basically.
In both regards. And I think his sort of experience as a former prime minister has really come into that. He's sort of, you know, having been prime minister for as long as he was, what was it, like 5-6 years? And he was quite good at communicating then. And I think he sort of understands quite well how to do the communication thing, whereas Rishi Sunak has not had that much experience as prime minister, doesn't really know what he's doing, and it sort of keeps repeating the same mistakes.
You said the phrase to the point, like David Cameron's, like those videos are, they're, yes, very information dense, they're very to the point. I think that is the clear dividing line between him and Sunak. Sunak's social media appearances, it's not entirely clear what he's trying to communicate. Like, he does those like videos of like him relaxing at home, or like wearing trendy shoes or something like that. And it's not really clear what the point is, whereas the David Cameron ones are very, very like, this is what I've done in my 100 days. Like, they have a very sort of strict formula, and again, really information dense. Rory, do you think this is going to be something that's going to actually like irritate Sunak and co? Like, or do you think that actually they're pretty happy,
I think,
to be outshone by David Cameron?
I suppose it might be like mildly annoying if you see your own videos performing worsely. But I think in terms of like the grand scheme of things, probably not too troublesome for Rishi Sunak. It's not like David Cameron, as far as we're aware, is running like a shadow leadership campaign. You know, if this was Suella Braverman in cabinet doing these flashy videos, you think, well, she's obviously gunning for his job. I don't think David Cameron is doing that. Maybe I'll be proven wrong.
That'd be a wild turn.
Yeah.
I would say I completely agree. It's not like he's doing this to become leader, but I think the fact that you've got someone who is so good at media in cabinet sort of makes your failure at media just more obvious.
Yeah, I think it's sort of...
It cuts both ways, doesn't it? On one hand, it's quite nice to have a competent politician in your cabinet, and the other hand...
Because they're on the same team, ultimately.
It's a classic classic British politician dilemma. Like, do you have the big beast in your cabinet, or do you try and keep them at arm's length?
Yeah. I think it probably is good for Rishi Sunak, given that he's not a kind of foreign policy person, to have someone who is, you know, on top of all those things. So I think overall, it's probably a good thing. Like, from Rishi Sunak's perspective, he's probably quite happy with it. But I swing between thinking, is David Cameron good at this kind of communication, or has the bar just been kind of set so low that he's just stepping over it?
We talked about this last week. Is it just that this generation of politicians are rubbish?
Yeah.
That's too strong. But you know what I mean?
David Cameron, you know, he clearly didn't communicate very well during the Brexit referendum, or didn't communicate well enough. I guess he won an election in 2015. They won the Scottish referendum. You know, he's got mixed results, basically. And I feel like, I don't think he's a uniquely
approval of his communication style back in the 2010s. Like, people were saying, like, oh, he's a bit too sort of like posh and Italian. Yeah. You know, he doesn't have the sort of people such. I mean, not like saying he's a man of the people now. But like, there definitely is a sense
in which
it's more unanimous.
To be fair, as foreign secretary, you don't have to go and interact with regular people
this
too much.
Like, I would say as well, between 2010 and 2015, he was criticised. And one of the things he was criticised for in the run-up to the 2015 election was this, like, he was repeating the same phrases over and over. Like, it's like he's got quite a tight, he's quite good at keeping
good
to
point.
A tight message.
Yeah.
And that was criticised. But now I think that is becoming a positive, because Sunak is doing this, as you say, like, I feel like he knows he's not a particularly good communicator, so he's resorting to these gimmicks to try and like catch people's attention and to try and like get in the news cycle. So having someone who has such a tight sort of communication strategy is actually a positive at the minute. Like, then the negatives of Cameron in 10 to 15 were that it was like too managed, whereas now, being too managed, when you compare to Sunak and obviously Truss and Johnson before that, like, having someone who is too managed on communication is actually a positive and increases their credibility.
Also, the issue of being too managed only really becomes an issue if you're constantly on the airwaves, because then people feel like it's repetitive, whereas actually a little bit of sort of density is really appreciated if you're only appearing in the occasional like foreign secretary Twitter video.
I would also just like to because I know we've all sort of praised Cameron at the minute, but I would say that I think it's actually, he's in a particularly easy position to do well in at the minute. He doesn't receive any sort of criticism because he's in the Lords, so he doesn't have to be in the Commons, he doesn't have to receive all of the, like, you know, media focus that you get from doing debates in the Commons and all of that. Like, he doesn't need to do any of that. He doesn't engage himself in any sort of domestic debates, so any of the things about, like, the smoking thing yesterday, he wasn't engaged in that. I mean, a lot of other politicians, like their track record for voting for the last 5 years have been brought up on like trans issues and things like that, hasn't been involved in any of that. So none of that is detracting from his message. Like, he's in a uniquely pretty easy position.
He doesn't have a constituency that he has to worry about holding on to.
The other thing with being with foreign tax generally is that you like there's only so much difference you can make.
Yeah.
You know, like if he tells Netanyahu, please stop it, and Netanyahu doesn't stop it, no one goes like, oh, you failed there, haven't you? Or if he, you know, tries to, as he did, convince Republicans to increase support to Ukraine and they don't do it, no one blames Cameron for not doing that. So it's one of those situations where you can only really get credit and there's not actually so much criticism.
Unless you make like available. An absolutely massive blunder, which so far he hasn't done.
Which is a low bar.
Yeah.
But also, Ben, you talked about that, about the fact that he is a lord.
Yeah.
So the way you're talking about that, it sounded like you don't really approve of having lords in cabinet.
I
like it personally. But this it's hard to deny that in relative terms, this has been a bit of a success.
Yeah,
so
completely.
A, why don't you think we should have lords in cabinet? And B, do you think David Cameron's relative success means we will have more lords in cabinet in the future?
So,
you know, can you imagine Dav Cam being Labour's foreign secretary, for example?
Okay, there's so many things to unpack here. I don't know where to start. So my opposition to having lords in cabinet is that you still have scrutiny in the Lords, it should be pointed out. Like, he will still make statements from the Lords, but if there is ever a statement that needs to be made to the House of Commons, you'll send a junior minister from the Foreign Office to make that statement in the House of Commons, which means that a lot of the scrutiny you get from other MPs will be just directed to a junior. So you're not receiving that criticism, but you're getting all of the praise for the success. So I don't think that that's necessarily fair. I think the way that sort of cabinet is understood to work is that you can be held to account in the House of Commons chamber. That has been sort of convention. Now, I know that other people are
I was going to say, that's why, I mean, they've now just appointed, I think it's Andrew Mitchell as Deputy Foreign Secretary, which is a made up position because you sort of need someone that feels like they have authority in the Commons.
I know that the argument against this is, we have had lords in the cabinet before. You know, there was some... I think it was for Thatcher or something in the 70s or 80s.
Lord Carrington.
Yeah.
Well, didn't we have...
That's
a foreign secretary.
Foreign secretary. And then in 2005, we had Lord Adonis as something.
Legal thing.
Yeah.
Wasn't
I can't remember his exact position. But yeah, so it has happened
wasn't
before.
Wasn't Peter Mandelson also a Lord and sort of in cabinet with that portfolio?
I believe so at one point, yes.
Love it.
So it has happened before, but it's not press. And the other thing to note is that there haven't really been, other than Lord Carrington, it's not been one of the great offices of state. So, you know, minister without portfolio, for example, makes a bit more sense because you're sort of in cabinet just to generally advise on vague, like, but you haven't got an actual like portfolio that you're in charge of. That's the whole point. But so I don't agree with it on those grounds because you're getting a lot of the praise and you're not being held to account to the same degree.
Well, you're doing a lot of nodding. Is this implicative of agreement?
I agree in the general sort of principle, but I think it more broadly that comes from my sort of uncomfortable and discomfort as well.
Yeah.
My discomfort with the existence of the House of Lords. I think the way, you know, in the system we've got, it's probably fine. I don't think I'd want like every great office of state to be held by someone in the Lords. I think it'd be very bad, but in a very case by case basis, I think
like
it's probably fine.
17th century, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Very good chap.
Yeah. So I think really it's a problem with the wider system than this specific.
What do you mean?
As
in like you, the
as in
the Lords
we've got
aren't...
Lords and they're able to be in cabinet. Like that is the system. It's not like Rishi Sunak has bent the rules to get him in. But
he has gone a bit against convention, though.
Yeah, I suppose so. And also...
But it's not like a formalised convention. It's sort of one that's developed over the last couple of decades or so.
Yeah.
It's not like
that. Yeah, and there will be people who make the case that actually part of the reason why David Cameron's been pretty hot on foreign policy since he became Foreign Secretary is because he hasn't had to worry about re-election and that type of thing. But then you can say, well, maybe we shouldn't have... Let's just get... Less and less elections or fewer elections.
You're getting it. Exactly.
Let's just end democracy.
Let's just get Mario Draghi as king of Europe.
Yeah,
why not?
Exactly.
I know that your other question was, why do you think this is a
get
success?
Back to that, please.
And I think that the part of it is, part of the reason that it's been a success is sort of the thing that I'd already pointed out, that he, unlike other previous foreign ministers, they haven't had to contend with a lot of the domestic arguments in the UK and all of that. Like, he's in a very fortunate position. The position that he's been in has worked very well because he's avoided a lot of the scrutiny that you would usually be under. And I don't think that that is an argument for doing this going forward. But I do actually think, and I know that you asked, you know, do you think this is going to happen going forward? I think it's likely that it could. I think that you will probably, maybe not with Starmer, but I think future prime ministers might look back on this episode and see it as that was very successful. They managed to avoid a lot of the scrutiny. They managed to just, almost step aside from UK politics and go and do the foreign affairs thing outside of Westminster, outside of the political fray, and just focus on that. So maybe they will look back at this and think that that was a success. Why not replicate it?
It's interesting. This could be a turning point, couldn't it, for sort of cabinet politics?
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, this could be the beginning of...
Maybe we should have a more American-style system where we don't get our cabinet members from the elected government, yeah, from the elected parliament.
I think it was, yeah, one of the issues with the current system is that there's such a lack of expertise in so many of these offices. I mean, it makes less of a difference if, like, you're some minor minister, you know, like a deputy trade secretary, and you happen to just be an MP with no formal, like, education in trade politics or whatever. But something as important as foreign secretary, the fact that we have not just MPs without any real experience or expertise in foreign affairs, but also this ministerial churn where we have a new one every couple of months because of basically how it interplays with domestic UK politics. That's madness to me. I quite like that for really important offices of state, we have ministers who are able to sort of slightly float above the churn of domestic UK politics.
But the argument for cabinet ministers is they're not meant to be the experts. You have people who are employed in the foreign, you know, in the foreign office, in the home office, that are experts in that. And the MPs are meant to be the representatives of the people in the rooms. They get given the briefings and they make the decisions and they have a mandate provided to them by the people. If you start putting experts in, who head cabinet positions, what is the difference between them and the experts already employed in the Foreign Office, and where does the representation from the people come?
So two things on that. One, I think that's a matter of degree. Like, sure, there's a sense in which you already have experts in there, but to be able to make informed decisions, you still need a degree of expertise in the first place as a minister. The other thing is that I think that that sort of reasoning, the chat about mandates, basically, that applies very much so to big domestic policy areas, you know.
Like foreign affairs, for instance.
That's not a domestic policy area.
Right,
but my point with the reason it doesn't really apply to foreign policy is no one goes into a manifesto saying our position on the upcoming October 7th Israel-Gaza war is going to be this, or our position on the war in Ukraine is going to be this. You go in saying, oh, people vote on the NHS and housing and taxes or whatever, both because of the things that we can control in like our domestic politics and because those are things that are like permanent issues. Foreign policy is far more ad hoc. And so that's when I think having expertise is really far more valuable, because there is no sense in which you can give a foreign policy mandate. Not really. You can be like generically hawkish or generically dovish, but that's not even really a policy. That's just sort of like a posture. And once you've sort of, I mean, Derek Cameron is obviously going to agree with the government's general posture on these sorts of things. But once you're past that point, you then just do need expertise because it is very ad hoc.
I do think that... I would put more emphasis on the fact that those policy positions do come up in the run-up to sort of general elections, and that like party stance on like China and how close you want to be with America, like that comes up. Like you are voting partly on that. That is in manifestos. We know how parties stand on that. And I agree that foreign policy is still ad hoc, but like I don't think it's fair to say that we don't know how a party is going to act or like it, that you can't like vote on that and provide a mandate on that. I think you still can. And I also think that there is still like, yes, of course, you need some expertise in particular areas and you need to understand something to do with foreign affairs if you're the foreign secretary. But again, like the people that have been the civil service who have had like decades of experience there are the people who are, should be providing you with like policy briefings and providing you with substantive information to make decisions on. And the role of, you know, someone from the cabinet is to just decide what the options are. I don't think you need, the expert should be in the civil service. The representation from the people should be, you know, from the cabinet, and that should be who should be heading the department.
We made an argument here. We clearly, like, don't agree on this one. But
no, clearly not.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I think the interesting thing is the future, is whether or not this is the beginning of Lords in cabinet, or at least that happening more often. The last question then on Davcam is whether or not we think he is sort of independently molding foreign policy. And this sort of relates to the argument we've just had. Mm. It's basically how much sort of autonomy does David Cameron have in foreign policy? Because some of his statements do seem to be slightly off the cuff, especially when it comes to Israel and Gaza. And he said some pretty critical stuff, I think, of Netanyahu. Some of it actually, when David Cameron's talking about it, has referred back to his previous experience as prime minister in the 2020s. He's talking about Netanyahu and said that we used to have lots of disagreements, that sort of thing. And that sort of coded criticism of the way that Israel is prosecuting the war in Gaza. I think this is the question basically is how much is he actually shaping foreign policy versus how much is he being directed by Sunak? I think the reason that this is a difficult question to answer is because so much of what we describe as foreign policy is actually literally just sort of your sort of stated rhetorical position. Yeah. And so even very subtle shifts in rhetorical tone can effectively change your foreign policy. So, like, how much do we think this is being directed by Sunak versus Cameron?
I think it leans pretty heavily towards David Cameron, because you look at things like you look at people like Oliver Dowd and Rishi Sunak and the things that they've said, they've been fairly, you know, they're talking about pretty unconditional support for Israel, whereas David Cameron has been really quite critical of the Netanyahu government. Things like restrictions on aid going into Gaza, you know, just the general sort of prosecution of the war, and that type of thing. Like, I do think it really is coming from David Cameron. And like you said, it just, all it takes to sort of change policy is for him to say a few sentences, and then that sort of is the policy. I mean, he was sort of responsible for getting one of the Israeli government spokespeople fired from their job because of this argument that they got into on Twitter over Israel's restrictions of aid going to Gaza. Like, he's not afraid to sort of hold back at all. Whereas I think the more domestic politicians like Sunak, like Oliver Dowden, they are a lot less willing to say those things.
They also just fall back on very formulaic statements. Yeah. Like, you have tons of phrases like, we stand by Israel, which will just get sort of parroted and like carried out every time someone asks Sunak or Dowden a question about Gaza. I guess this is sort of inevitable, though, isn't it? I mean, that is just the nature of foreign policy, is that in these sorts of situations, when it's less about sort of formal, substantial policies, you know, stuff like military aid or whatever, and it's more just about sort of diplomatic positioning, it's always going to be a little bit ad hoc. Yeah, it's always going to be up to the foreign secretary. Yeah, I guess so.
No, I think I broadly agree with Rory. I think we've seen David Cameron is just demonstrably more critical of Israel than the wider government. And I think he has been pulling foreign policy more in that direction. Some of his statements have been sort of directly critical of the way that Israel have prosecuted the war so far. I think in the direct aftermath of October the 7th, Sunak came out and sort of said that there is unconditional sort of UK support for Israel. And David Cameron explicitly a few weeks ago said that there were limits to our support. Like, even just on that, you can see that he's pulled foreign policy in that direction. So, yeah, I think he has had, you know, his more critical approach to Israel has dragged the government in that direction.
Yeah. There's a Spectator piece recently where they were saying Tory MPs are very confused by this, by the fact that David Cameron is apparently more or less pro-Israel than the government, because he was quite pro-Israel during his time in office. But I think there's something we talked about last week on the podcast. Actually, what happened is David Cameron started off being quite sort of sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, and then over the couple of years of his premiership, he became more pro-Israel.
I know that you always like bringing this quote up, but he did describe, I think it was in 2010, Gaza as an open-air prison, and then doubled down on the statement afterwards. Mm-hmm.
And the last thing we're just going to mention in passing is that Ben has been particularly irked by this piece, I think in Unheard, was it?
Yeah.
Where there was a suggestion. Actually, it wasn't. I mean, we say it was in Unheard. It was an idea first floated by former Labour Shadow Chancellor. Was he Shadow Chancellor? Ed Balls.
Yeah.
And then also agreed with by George Osborne about maybe David Cameron staying on as Foreign Secretary for the incoming Keir Starmer government. Ben, what do you think?
Obviously not. I think it's just so ridiculous. The reason it angered me is that even just being brought up gives it more sort of importance than it deserves. It's obviously never going to happen. That's an absolutely mad... I mean, this is one of those things where it's going to happen and it's going to be clipped and it's going to go, he knows nothing. Yeah. But I'm that sure, like, I'm happy to see him as flustered and angry about this as I am, because it makes no sense. He's been a former Conservative Prime Minister. He's clearly wanted something to do in the last... Like, he was bored being out of politics and wanted something to do. I think part of the reason he took it on is because he knows that they're going to lose the next election, so he only has to do it for a year. Like, he's obviously...
But he is good at Twitter, isn't he?
How would this look from Keir Starmer, that no one even within his own party, either in Parliament or out, is good enough to be Foreign Secretary that he has to resort to a former Conservative Prime Minister? Of course he's not going to do that.
It's just friendly bipartisanship. I love it.
The only world in which it would happen, if there was some really chaotic hung parliament where they needed to then form some weird like national unity government, it's just not going to happen.
David Cameron is not going to replace David Lammy. We're not going to have Dav Cam for Dav Lam.
Nice. Very good.
No,
sorry. I have to give credit to one of our writers, Georgina, who came up with the Dav Cam, Dav Lam link. I don't know.
Is it good enough
to give credit to?
I think the awkward sort of like way that was pushed in, I don't think she's going to want credit.
Okay, let's move on. Okay.
Also, sorry, my last point. But I don't think David Lammy, Foreign Secretary, is going to be that radically different from David Cameron as Foreign Secretary. That might be a bombshell.
No, of course not in policy terms. I think there's not very much disagreement in foreign policy between Labour and the Conservatives at the moment. It's more just about style and what's the right way of putting this? Like, it's more about sort of style and your sort of standing on the world stage, and obviously David Cameron tops David Lammy on that metric.
For now.
That's why you think David Cameron's going to continue under Keir Starmer, right?
I just think it'd be fun. Yeah, that's all. I mean, it's not going to happen, you're right, but I think it'd be fun. Okay, that is everything, I think, with David Cameron. That was quite a lot of David Cameron. This takes us to the final bit of the podcast, which is the World Leader Leaderboard. For those of you who don't know what this is when we basically move one world leader each up and one world leader down. A disclaimer that we always put in this part of the podcast, this is not reflective of personal politics. This is just from that leader's perspective, had they had a good week or a bad week, as it were. Okay, so can we start with Rory? Who is going down for you?
Going down is Yoon Suk-yeol, the president of South Korea. Nice. He had a pretty shockingly bad week because last week, I think it was just after the podcast was recorded last week, South Korea had legislative elections where his party sort of was... Well, the opposition party, I should say, won in a landslide.
Yeah.
The opposition already had a parliamentary majority, and they strengthened their parliamentary majority halfway through his presidential term. So for the first few years of his term, the opposition majority parliament was just like really stopping him from being able to do anything. And that's a dynamic that's just going to continue. I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but I think they are pretty close to being at the point where in theory they could impeach him if they wanted to. He's focused a lot on foreign policy, boosting ties with the US, for example. But domestically, it's a bit of a nightmare. They've got massive doctor strikes. They've got, housing crisis. They've got demographic crisis as well. He wants to do lots of kind of government reforms that he can't do because he needs parliament to approve them. So, yeah, I think the next few years for him, he's just going to sink even further.
Yeah, South Korea has an appallingly acute housing crisis, actually. And a lot of it stems from the complete national dominance of Seoul as a metropolitan area. Like the fact that something like 50% of all of South Korea lives in Seoul metro area, which is just like, it's a wild number. Yeah. I mean, we talked about this in one of our videos on South Korea's demographic crisis, but that, London, we think the UK is too London-centric. Yeah. Something like 10% of the UK's population lives in Greater London, maybe 15, something like that. Imagine 50% living in that area. It's 26 million people in one metro area.
Jeez. It's what you're aspiring to, though, isn't it?
London.
People don't give away my politics here, but yes, I would love that.
Shall I go and move him? Or
I'll move them all down once we've done everyone going down. Ben, who is going down for you?
So he's not quite had that bad a week, I don't think, but Donald Trump. So obviously you brought up at the beginning that Biden has overtaken him in polling, which is probably, very bad news for him. But he's also... apparently fallen asleep in his trial this week, which is also pretty significant. So it's his trial about hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. It's more detracting from his campaign efforts. Obviously, there's the financial component to it as well. Just a really pretty bad week for Donald Trump.
It's also
Trump
a reminder
overall.
That he's quite old.
Yeah,
right? He's fighting loads of legal battles, doing a lot of traveling, doing a lot of campaigning. That's going to take its toll on you.
And his whole Sleepy Joe quip is not going to go down particularly
well.
Although
I actually imagine that him falling asleep at his trial probably goes down quite well with his base.
Yeah, weirdly.
He'll say he was resting his eyes or something.
Well, also that he doesn't even care. Like, he's so confident he's going to be acquitted that he's just passing out.
There's I can't remember which cases it was talking about, but he's in this situation where his lawyers in one case are trying to delay the start of one trial because he needs to be in New York for this trial and he can't get to Florida or Georgia for this other one. And it's just... He's in such a bad legal situation. Yeah. I mean, being on trial in having one trial for a former president is unprecedented. Having four in an election year where he is running for re-election is just unthinkable.
He's the first president or former president to have a criminal case brought against him. The fact that he's not only the first to have that, but to have multiple.
Yeah, he's in for a penny,
He's in for a penny, yeah. The Trump situation is one of the reasons why I am quite sort of optimistic about Biden's chances going 2024. Obviously, the polling is moving in that direction. But I think as people realize that Trump actually is the candidate and that he actually would be president, as it becomes sort of more real, people realize that electing a dude who's got however many charges against him and could quite possibly be sentenced midway through his term is quite insane. We have a Republican who writes for us. I won't give him his name away, but he is supremely pessimistic about what happens if Trump gets elected. You know, he really worries that would be the end of the Republican Party, because Trump would be elected and then sentenced, and then that would just spark an enormous row.
I think the Trump sort of takeover of the Republican Party has really sort of damaged the party in the short and possibly long term, because...
Hot take that.
Yeah. They have this thing now where a lot of the candidates that are being picked for these important state level or like congressional races, the people from the Trump wing, I don't want to paint everyone with, you know, with the same brush, but they're not electorally good.
No,
you know, you've got a guy in North Carolina running for governor, which should be a state that Republicans could win, who is, I can't remember the exact details, but he's incredibly extreme in his views on things like gay rights, abortion, and, you know, even comments about the Holocaust that you think just outrageous for anyone, let alone a, you know, high level candidate to say. You just think when they're picking these candidates, every state they pick a bad candidate, and they're just sacrificing a chance to take back the Senate or keep the House or, you know, win another governorship. And like, I think the Democrats must just be feeling really good about it.
But there is something symmetrical happening to a lesser extent, obviously, in the Democrat Party, in that sort of internal Democrat politics does dictate who they choose for their candidates. Yeah. And sometimes those guys aren't, let's just say, electorally optimal. Basically, they're too far to the left on the American political spectrum to command majorities. And the same thing has clearly happened with the Trump thing. It's just that they're even further on the sort of like, well, the Trump right, and therefore even less unpopular. No, I think it's an interesting dynamic, and it's sort of like a vicious loop. Once you're into it just gets worse, because you just get more and more Trump loyalists or sort of like Trumpist politicians, and then you elect even more Trumpy politicians as your candidates. Anyway, so my person going down is Ursula von der Leyen. And she's going down for a variety of reasons. I mean, basically, until quite recently, she was sort of a shoo-in for re-election as Commission President, which happens in early June, I think. Was it July? Early June?
June. Parliamentary elections are in June.
It's 6 to 9, isn't it? So, but there have been a couple of things recently that have slightly hampered her chance. I think she's still probably the favourite. But there are at least three things, I think, that have happened. One, and I think this is one that made the most headlines, was her trip to Israel immediately after October 7th, where she was... pretty steadfast in her support for Netanyahu in Israel. And I think quite a lot of Europeans, politicians, were quite uneasy about that at the time. Mm. But as the war in Gaza has gone on and Netanyahu's taken increasingly controversial action, they've become more and more vocal about their opposition to von der Leyen's policy on that. The other thing is she's currently been investigated by the European Public Prosecutor's Office over some texts she sent. It's a really ridiculously complicated story and very, very opaque, so we don't really want to go into it now. But over some texts she sent basically organising a vaccine procurement contract during the pandemic. It's not dissimilar to some of the controversy we had in the UK over the slightly like dodgy way that procurement contracts were awarded in the height of the pandemic and justified on sort of like emergency terms. And the last thing is, and this is very, very recent, is that she basically, it's a small post in the commission. It's the small and medium-sized businesses commissioner, something like that. Yeah. And she chose someone. So she's formerly of the CDU. She still is of the CDU, but obviously she's not as associated as she was. And she chose a fellow CDU MEP to take the post, despite the fact there have been reports that two other candidates both scored higher on the relevant tests. And she's faced calls to basically not appoint him. She went ahead and appointed him anyway, but then he immediately resigned because he said that he couldn't hold his position in good faith. And it sparked a bit of a sort of internal feud within the commission between different commissioners, most notably Thierry Breton, who was criticising von der Leyen's appointment, despite the fact that he actually served under von der Leyen a while ago. And it's a sort of a loss for von der Leyen, essentially. So I think basically the point here is that she was a shoo-in until quite recently, and now looks slightly more up in the air. I will move those, but while I do that, could I have Rory, who's going down, and then Ben, Ben, who's going up?
Mine won't take long, so I'm moving Joe Biden up. We've sort of covered the inverse. But he's doing a lot better in polling than he was. Trump legal battles, financial problems, all sort of create this... a little bit of momentum for Joe Biden. If you do want to know more, you should go to TLDR Global and watch the video that came out that I wrote and like it and comment. But there's not much more to say about him.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And to be fair, same for me, there's not much more to say about my person going up because it's David Cameron.
Great.
And we've sort of covered all the reasons why he's going up. I think he's obviously been doing very well on the communication front. I do think he's been upstaging Rishi Sunak. I think that his plan to sort of almost try and rehabilitate his image by being foreign secretary, especially after being the prime minister that lost the Brexit referendum, I think that's going quite well for him. Like, I think he probably had a plan in his head of how being foreign secretary would go, and I think it's probably actually exceeding that.
Yeah, nice. And so who's at the top now?
I think that's everyone, and eagle-eyed watchers have noticed that my person going up is Sadiq Khan, and that is for the very simple reason that the mayor elections are about to happen. The London mayor elections are about to happen next couple of weeks, and Sadiq Khan is almost guaranteed to win. The Conservative candidate, Susan Hall, is not an especially strong candidate, has made a series of gaffes. And this is all despite the fact that the Tories changed the electoral system to try and disadvantage Sadiq Khan a couple of months ago, but it basically hasn't worked. I was going to put Putin up, but he's already at the top of the board, slightly depressingly. because I don't want to talk about it too long because he's not actually moving, but this is basically about oil and the fact that oil prices are going up. But not only that, the discount between Russian oil and every other oil is closing because Russia's finding more effective ways to get around sanctions. And the last thing is that the Biden administration is coming in on increasing pressure to effectively enforce the sanctions against Iran more effectively than it has done in the past couple of months. It's sort of tacitly loosened them in an attempt to try and get Iran back to the negotiating table with the nuclear deal a couple of months ago. And this will be even more good news for Putin because not only will it mean higher oil prices, it'll also probably mean that there'll be better prices for his sanctioned oil. That is, I think, everything.
Yeah.
We're happy with that?
This for me.
Nice. Okay. Well, thank you very much for watching. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. Leave any positive or negative criticism down in the comments below, and hopefully we'll see you again next week.
Cool. Thank you.
Nice.
Yeah. I'd be interested to see if anyone leaves any comments about them thinking that David Cameron will stay on as foreign secretary.